Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very warm welcome to this edition of Africa Link. It's Tuesday, June the 12th. My name is Abubakar Jallo.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe, also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Please don't hesitate to leave us your comments, feedback, and to share the audio.
And coming up, the plight of children working in hazardous conditions in Kenya on this World Day Against Child Labor.
My work here is to fill these spices in small polythene bags and then seal it with heat from these candles. I do casual jobs here.
I came here when I was 16 years because I had problems paying my school fees.
It's official, Nigeria celebrates Democracy Day today instead of the usual May 29th. Why did President Muhammadu Buhari decide to change the date? We hear from a correspondent.
June 12 was when Nigeria had nice presidential election and the candidate was accepted all over the country. It was a Muslim ticket for the first time. The Yorubas were a kind of offended by that annulment of the election.
We have a lot of stories lined up for you. Stay tuned for this and much more.
But first, let's listen to some of the stories that are making headlines across the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. U.S. President Donald Trump has ended his historic meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un in Singapore. Both leaders signed a joint declaration committing the North to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which Trump praised at a press conference on Tuesday.
Chairman Kim and I just signed a joint statement in which he reaffirmed his unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Our unprecedented meeting, the first between an American president and a leader of North Korea, proves that real change is indeed possible.
Follow-up meetings to discuss further details are expected shortly. Tensions are brewing between EU officials over a charity boat housing more than 600 mostly African migrants. French President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday accused the new populist Italian government of cynicism and irresponsibility for not allowing the migrants port entry. The migrants, including children and pregnant women, were rescued over the weekend off the coast of Libya and have been stranded in tight quarters aboard the ship Aquarius ever since. Rescuers said the migrants would soon be taken to Spain. They condemned Italy and also Malta for refusing the migrants port entry. Lawyers for Congolese ex-Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba have requested his immediate release from the International Criminal Court. Bemba has been in ICC detention since his arrest in 2008, but the court ruled last week that he could not be held criminally liable for crimes committed by his troops in the Central African Republic. The ICC said his fate would be decided in the coming days. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. In Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel is set to host her Austrian conservative counterpart, Sebastian Kurz, for talks on the country's refugee policy. The Austrian prime minister has been openly critical of Merkel's policy that allowed for hundreds of thousands of refugees to enter Germany in 2015. Merkel has said she would seek Kurz to employ a flexible refugee system that abides by EU solidarity. Also, the German state of Lower Saxony has recalled thousands of eggs from organic farms in the Netherlands that were contaminated with the chemical fipronil. The six German states are affected by the recall. The banned substance also contaminated millions of eggs last year in the Netherlands. And finally, reigning football champions Germany have arrived in Russia on Tuesday to join in on preparations for the World Cup games. Germany aims to join Brazil as five-time cup winners. They beat Argentina in the final 4 years ago, and the games kick off on Thursday. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Abubakar Jallo. Let's start off with some breaking news. Former Vice President of the Democratic Republic of Congo, that's Jean-Pierre Bemba, will be released from custody from the International Criminal Court. That's according to Reuters News Agency. We will continue to monitor these particular stories for you.
Many thanks, Abubakar Jallo, for that breaking news. Now, as the world commemorates the Day Against Child Labor with the theme, Generation Safe and Healthy, poverty, the UN says that one in every five children in Africa are involved in child labor. These children do not go to school and have little or no time to play.
Now, more than half of them are exposed to the worst forms of child labor, such as working in hazardous environments, slavery, or other forms of forced labor. Diana Wanyonyi in Mombasa met two young children who are working as casual laborers. This is her report.
I am at Kongowea Market, the busiest and largest open-air market on the Kenyan coast that attracts traders from across East Africa. Lying over 4 hectares of land, this market has more than 10,000 traders, 30% of whom are children under the age of 18, according to the data from Kongowea Market Traders Union. Some of these children sell food and reusable bags in the market. Others package spices in polythene bags for their employers or head carry luggage for shoppers. Two of the young boys packing cumin and cinnamon seeds agreed to speak to me on condition of anonymity. They are 16 and 17 years old, and I will call them John and David. John tells me he works for his family, while David says he has no option but to work.
My work here is to fill these spices in small polythene bags and then seal it with heat from these candles. I came here to my uncle's place, who is a businessman in this market, because my parents were unable to raise my school fees. I do casual jobs here. I just have to persevere. On a good day, I make 700 to 800 shillings, and on a bad day, I go home with 300 shillings.
300 per day sometimes.
I came here when I was 16 years because I had problems paying my school fees. I came here because there is a lot of jobs and there is no way you cannot get money elsewhere. I stay with my parents and they are okay with me working rather than staying at home and causing a lot of stress.
This is the reason the United Nations agreed in 2002 that June 12th is the World Day Against Child Labor Day to highlight the plights of children like John and David. The UN says nearly 220 million children between 5 and 17 years are in employment worldwide. In Africa, the picture is very grim, with almost half that figure. In terms of prevalence, the figure stands at 1 in 5. Here at the Kongowea Market, former chairman of the Kongowea Market Traders Union, Ali Mutsumi, says there is an increase in trend of the number of children dropping out of school and come to work here.
Katika soko yetu, vijana ni wengi sana.
In this market, there are a lot of young ones who drop out of Form 4 or college. There are those who did not go to school, and also children below 18 years. This is an open-air market, and anyone who wants to look for their luck are free to come here. Children below 18 years are wasting their time, but we can't blame them because of high standards of life, and maybe he is the breadwinner to his family.
According to Kenya's Children Act, Section 10, states that every child shall be protected from economic exploitation and any work that is likely to be hazardous or to interfere with the child's education or to be harmful to the child's health or physical, mental, spiritual, moral, or social development. Even though local authorities agree this is a major problem in the country, they also argue that most families rely on these children at the Kongowea Market to put food on the table.
Diana Wanyonyi reporting from the Kenyan coastal city of Mombasa.
And Abubakar, many of our users have been, you know, sending comments on how African governments can tackle child labor. And we begin with Katenje Sam, who says a lot is needed to help the African child also to have the same rights like those in America, Europe. Oh, well, that's a good one, isn't it?
A day. And Friday Yakle says a lot of those people force their children into labor haven't been to school themselves.
Eddie Young Willie says, is child labor only found in African countries? Please start saying positive and good things about African countries. We still have excess good attributes.
Okay. And a cool one here from Simon Castro. He just said, I was one of those kids. Thanks for all of your responses.
And keep the debate flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Now, following the historic summit in Singapore, U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to work together towards to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, while Washington also committed to provide security guarantees for its old enemies.
Now, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said on Tuesday that he supported the goals set out in the joint statement, but said Washington must be prepared to respond if Pyongyang does not follow through. Marie Sena reports.
Donald Trump was in visibly good spirits as he summed up the leaders' joint statement at a press conference earlier today.
Chairman Kim and I just signed a joint statement in which he reaffirmed his unwavering commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
In addition, Trump announced that the joint military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea would be halted, and he ultimately planned on bringing the nearly 30,000 U.S. soldiers in South Korea back home. According to the Russian news agency RIA, Moscow welcomed the announcement and said it was ready to assist in implementing the deal. However, while Trump optimistically spoke of a new chapter for both nations, several political analysts have stated that the summit yields symbolic rather than tangible results. The statement bears no detail and omits the words verifiable and irreversible when addressing denuclearization. This formulation is crucial as it implies that Pyongyang would allow inspections and would not rebuild any of its weapons after they are destroyed. Criticism has also been voiced as the widespread human rights abuses committed by the North were not directly addressed at the summit. DW spoke to Janka Oertel, a transatlantic fellow in the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund. She emphasized that while a diplomatic initiative is a more constructive approach than throwing threats,
this is legitimizing this North Korean regime. This is something that we could call collateral damage.
As the leaders concluded their highly anticipated stay in Singapore, it is clear that another meeting will be necessary to substantiate the historic statement that was signed today.
Marie Sena with that report. Now, let's go back to Africa for a while. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari sent shockwaves across the country when he declared today, June the 12th, as Democracy Day instead of May 29th. He has gazetted the declaration and thereby make the day a national public holiday.
Now, the decision has is deemed political, and many Nigerians said it was his move to get support from the ethnic Yoruba people in the south of the country. Ben Shimang has been telling me more.
Well, absolutely, that is where some people talk about the political angle to it. If you check, the defeated People's Democratic Party was sworn in on 29, 1999. For that reason, having witnessed too much of military interference in politics, they decided that that day was going to be Democracy Day. But you now have opposition that has come on board, so Buhari has decided to change the date to June 12. June 12 was when Nigeria had nice presidential election, and the candidate was accepted all over the country. It was a Muslim ticket for the first time. So Buhari just felt that the Yorubas were a kind of offended by that annulment of the election, and today's declaration of June 12 as Democracy Day is to kind of make amends and see if peace will return once again.
Do you think that President Buhari is using then this National Day to kind of appease the Yoruba, or his intention is just to cement that relationship between Northerners and Southerners?
In fact, I want to see them as all of the factors, including the fact that politics is also around the corner. 2019 is around the corner. There will be presidential election. And, of course, he's been able to penetrate the Yoruba areas, and he wants to hold that area very firm. Out of the six states in that area, there's only one state that belongs to the opposition.
Ben Shimang, speaking to me from Abuja.
And of course, many of you have been also been commenting on this story, whether it makes sense due to history. And Samson Kanayo says, if Buhari truly loves Abiola and not playing politics to get vote from South 2019, let him order investigation of his death so that the killers be brought to justice.
And a response here from Obi Nesta, he says, this is simple. All his administration is trying to do is to blame past administrations.
And another comment from Emmanuel Noyle says, it's great to acknowledge great strides for democracy, I must admit, but public holiday wouldn't help a less productive nation as this.
And Nguere Yusuf says, I see it's good for Nigerian people because here in Uganda, it can't help as Buhari has done.
Abu, these comments are getting more interesting, you know. James Harrison says, if not Tuluwa Yorubas, why now? Buhari is on the verge of proving Nigerians wrong.
Awesome. Thank you so much for all your responses. Keep it Africa Link. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Africa Link. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, they were once refugees in one of Africa's biggest refugee camps, but they beat all odds and are now successful.
The fact that I was able to come from this place and basically make somebody of myself. I'm also the first hijab-wearing model, and that's a huge deal for the community.
And also on the program, with only 3 days for the World Cup to kick off in Russia, we will be hearing how Russian President Vladimir Putin has invested billions of dollars in stadiums and infrastructure.
I should say, Abu, that also in the previous World Cups, like in South Africa and Brazil, many of these stadiums were built, but of course we don't know how what's happening to them right now.
I guess they are hoping to make publicity and make some money. But first, to Zambia, where the security industry is fast-growing and one of the most lucrative businesses in the country. Despite making huge profits from clients, the guards that do much of the work are paid peanuts.
In a country that has more guards than police officers, one would imagine that their take-home pay would be enough to sustain them and their families. But as DW's Cathy Short in the capital, Lusaka, found out, this is not the case because many are exploited by the employers and work under difficult conditions.
Time check 5:30 a.m. in central Lusaka, and security guards are preparing to change shifts. The majority of the guards are young men and women, presumably in their 20s and slightly above. However, their working conditions are precarious since their bosses can fire and hire any time. 23-year-old Mary Tembo explained to me how she copes with her daily routine.
I've just knocked off from my night shift. When we sleep on duty, the supervisor charges 150 kwacha from our salary automatically, yes. Our own shoes, no boots, no full uniform from the company. No food when we are guarding. Very dangerous, and we are very scared because there's no guns. When a thief comes, we just run away and go to hide, because we know that the thief can kill us. We don't have guns.
Like Mary Tembo, Davis Nyanga, another guard, is not entirely happy with what he earns.
My name is Davis Nyanga. I work for AMSEPT. It's a very difficult life which you are facing, because I don't manage with the money I'm getting from the company. Just struggle just like that. I'm suffering with my family all the time. I don't make it. I don't take my children to school, rentals. I don't manage. The money I'm getting is just too little.
Despite these challenges, the security guards soldier on with the hope that things will get better in the near future and with support from trade unions. Elaston Njovu, the Deputy Secretary General of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, told DW that there are plans to partner with other trade unions in Malawi and Kenya to recruit more security guards in order to cut down on workload.
Government needs to escalate inspections on security firms which are undercutting, or to see that there is compliance by security firms. Security unions are weak in our country, and there's need for government to be on their side, particularly because they are dealing with multinational firms which then become their employers. So it's important that security unions are supported.
Despite their meager salaries, security guards still find time to boost their morale.
And that report was compiled by Cathy Short from Lusaka.
Since we can't all be business owners, how can employees stop their bosses from exploiting them?
And I'm sure we have responses.
Exactly. Master Asidri, as he prefers to call himself, says we must learn to be business owners because we have the land.
And Miguru Moses says that's the trend in every sector in Africa. We are overworked and underpaid. Why do you think the Mediterranean Sea swallows a lot of people escaping their plight?
Just keep the debate flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And we'll be back right after this.
Africa on the move.
And for Africa Move segment this week, we will unusually take you to the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya that played host to poets, models, teachers, and athletes that were once refugees at this particular camp.
Now, their visit was facilitated partly by the UNHCR to talk about the negative perceptions attributed to refugees. The former refugees and now successful personalities share their experiences with the over 5,000 refugees from the Eastern African region. Andrew Asike was there and filed this report.
I am at the Kakuma refugee camp in northwestern Kenya, close to the porous Kenya-South Sudan border. The refugee camp here is home to more than 180,000 refugees, mostly from South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia. The visit by former refugees at Kakuma camp was inspiring and also meant to bring hope to those waiting to be relocated to safer countries. 20-year-old Halima Aden, a fashion model, was born at Kakuma refugee camp. Having fled her native Somalia due to war and civil conflict that ensued in 1994, hers is a story of accomplishment and perseverance.
I'm a black, Muslim, Somali-American woman, and I'm also from Kenya, and I'm also a refugee, but I think I'm a cool refugee. I'm so proud of that background. I never understood why people were ashamed to say where they came from. The fact that I was able to come from this place and basically make somebody of myself. I'm also the first hijab-wearing model, and that's a huge deal for the community. So today I was just seeing myself through the children's eye, you know, like just seeing myself in the children, and I was so overcome with emotion.
Mary Nyiriak Meka, a teacher and activist from South Sudan, believes that education can be used as a tool to transform refugees into responsible citizens.
I can say educating a refugee is educating the whole world, because in the first place, when you flee from your home and come to a refugee camp, it doesn't mean that you're disabled. It doesn't mean that you have nothing to offer. And it will be so painful if all these children go back home without that education. Them and those that stayed in the country will have the same level. They have a better chance of turning their devastated countries into a beautiful place that everyone is going to admire. They are the key for rebuilding our countries.
The TEDx event, co-organized by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, also came at an opportune time to highlight the cohesion among refugees and their host, the Turkana people, how such many diverse cultures can come together and live side by side harmoniously. The UN Refugee Agency has vowed to use education to safeguard the rights and well-being of people who have been forced to flee from their countries. Nearly 90,000 children are enrolled in 39 schools.
Andrew Wasike reporting from the refugee camp in the north of Kenya, that's Kakuma.
Abu, and as we promised, continue monitoring this story from the ICC, The Hague. The international judges have ordered the interim release of former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba, who was acquitted last week of war crimes after a decade behind bars. This is a story that is fast breaking, and of course, we'll keep monitoring it.
And there is still further update to Congo as well. A story that just broke. Congolese President, that's Joseph Kabila, has said he is not going to run for a third term. That is, he's not going to seek re-elections.
Wow, lots of developments from the DRC topic here. Indeed. Anyway, stay with us. We still have much more to come.
Focus Europe.
Now, the world's biggest and most expensive football World Cup is days away from kicking off, and it will showcase Russia once again on the international stage.
Indeed, Abu, and President Putin has invested billions of dollars in building new stadiums and upgrading airports and roads in the hope of creating an economic bounce. But as Dan Ashby reports, changing the West's perception of Russia may be much harder.
A row of more than 30 banners are fluttering next to me here on one of Moscow's most iconic bridges. It was near here where Boris Yeltsin stood atop of a tank to defend the new Russia. Nearly 30 years on, and that Russia will be in the spotlight again like never before. And these banners all across Moscow leave you in no doubt as to why the World Cup is here.
And Russia 2018 is attracting as much noise as its countdown events. Costing more than $13 billion, it's the most expensive World Cup ever.
You don't have to go very far in Moscow to find building works, pavements being improved, metros dug up. The government has spent billions on new stadiums and roads, but that's all in a country where many people complain they don't even have a viable pension.
You can see they are improving the sidewalks and upgrading things, yes. But that amount of money? I'm not sure it's worth it.
It's an international event and lots of people will visit our country, so perhaps it's justified.
Cities like Nizhny Novgorod have new 44,000-seater stadiums. And yet, the local team's last home game attracted a crowd of barely 600. But chief analyst Denis Davidov of the economic research firm Nordea wrote a report on the cost of the World Cup. He insists Russia won't be left with empty stadiums.
Of course, after the tournament is held in cities like Saransk and Yekaterinburg, most likely the infrastructure will not only be used for sport. Probably they will be converted to host major economic and social forums, and perhaps other sporting events as well.
But this is all President Putin's pet project. And whatever the cost, he senses a PR opportunity. Russia's relations with the West have declined in the wake of EU and US sanctions, and after the UK accused it of poisoning a former Russian spy and his daughter on UK soil. The World Cup is an unrivaled chance to change the narrative, showing leadership, splendour and hospitality, as former Russian international footballer Dmitry Bulykin told me.
Yeah, I think they will surprise for sure, because the news, it's a one side, but if you see it's in real, it's another side. And I think everybody will surprised what Russia is a nice country with the nice people, and we like football, we like sport, and we like friendship.
Of course, there are likely to be logistical upsets. Some cities have already sold out of accommodation and fans will have to cope with huge distances between games. But once it starts, the football will bring a feel-good factor that will surely help Russia. Less clear is whether that will last. Already the UK and other countries are refusing to send top delegations to attend the opening ceremony. And it may take more than money and football to reset Russia's image beyond the game.
Dan Ashby with that report. Abu, I see you have something interesting you want to tell.
Indeed. What can you learn from Kenya?
About?
Well, that's the question we've been asking after a Zambian parliamentary delegation is in Kenya to learn how to effectively fight corruption.
Oh, yes. I can see some comments here. Matipa Bolia Mulenga says, sometimes I feel ashamed about my country. DW, please forgive them. The fact is, I love this country. I cannot change my citizenship.
And then we have Bob Calligraph, who says, that is despicable. Kenya, in now almost every sector of Kora, has been marked dry by corrupt officials.
And Ndeso has just sent it a comment. It says, and no, Kenya can't teach anyone anything about fighting corruption. An African country learning how to fight corruption from another African country is like a fox learning how to take care of a chicken from a hyena. Oh, I love that.
That is a good analogy. And now one here from Lord Libanos, he says, the recent reconciliation in Kenya means a lot, that it can teach Africa the way. Few presidents can do what Kenyan leaders did.
And Jack Henry says, no way. It must be the other way round, I believe. Like Kenya learning from Zambia, I guess that's what you meant, Abu.
But I mean, of course, those countries need to share.
Exactly. Maybe how
stuff.
Both of them can fight corruption. Marco Duck says, ridiculous. At Zambian leadership must be joking. I hope they are there to learn how to corrupt, because through the continent, Kenya and Nigeria, known as the place where the big thieves of the continent are developed. Okay, many thanks for those comments.
Those are your responses there. It's been a pleasure. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. Bye
Until
for
next
now.
Time. Bye.